Welcome to the Sunstone Podcast, everyone. I am your favorite co-host, Stephen Carter. The holiday season is here, and so I have a little present for you. You know those little ads we have in each episode for the Sunstone Magazine podcast? Well, today, you get to hear one. This one is a holiday podcast where we approach Santa Claus from two different perspectives. Because since there's more than one way to Mormon, then obviously there has to be more than one way to Santa. So if you enjoy this episode, come on over to patreon.com/sunstone and become a patron. We have a ton of great recordings that'll bring you deep into the best that Sunstone has to offer. You might as well treat yourself and become a patron for Christmas. I promise you'll love it. So, without further ado, and with a little ho ho ho, or not, I give you the Sunstone Santa Special. This segment is entitled Confessions of a Santa Dissenter by L.K. Gillespie. L.K. Gillespie is professor of sociology and chair of the Criminal Justice Department at Weber State University in Ogden, Utah. Because of his annual Anti-Claus lecture, he has received prestigious awards such as radio station FM X96's Boner of the Day Award and the Ogden Standard Examiner's Santa's Naughty List. A lie which is half a truth is ever the blackest of lies. Alfred Lord Tennyson. Santa kneeling at the manger? Santa hanging from the cross? I've given my annual Anti-Claus lecture for more than 35 years at 6 different universities and colleges, and before such diverse audiences as local churches, civic organizations, and the Sunstone Symposium. Because my wife and I have never taught our children to believe in Santa Claus, our neighbors have kept their children away from our home at Christmas time. And I'm a pariah in my ward because I protest every time Santa is brought into our meeting house for Christmas parties. Stuffed Santas in mousetraps mysteriously appear under my office door, along with verse, reindeer food, and poop. Quote, "For all the souls who hate the noise of Christmas cheer and lights and toys, for Mr. Scrooge and Mrs. Too, here's a little gift for you. A lump of coal won't be enough to make up for the shine and fluff, so here's a scoop of reindeer poop to offset all the Christmas goop." Unquote. We receive Christmas cards that warn, "The world is full of two kinds of people, those who believe in Santa Claus and communists." Another favorite. "Money's short, times are hard. Here's your effing Christmas card." I've even discovered notes attached to my car which read, "Don't mess with Santa. Signed, the elves." In what I'm sure are well-intentioned acts of charity, anonymous donors have rented Santas to appear on my doorstep on Christmas Eve bearing gifts from Santa for my children. One of my junior high school teachers sent me a note calling me a fathead. Others have used the less creative jerk, and I've received plenty of shame on you messages. Each year, I receive new creative versions of 'Twas the Night Before Christmas. Some I can share, others not. Here's a favorite. "'Twas the night before Christmas, and Santa was a wreck. How to live in a world that's politically correct? His workers no longer would answer to elves. Vertically challenged, they were calling themselves." And of course, I am privy to all the latest emails, including the suggestion that Santa Claus is really a she, not a he, because, quote, "Christmas is a big, organized, warm, fuzzy, nurturing, social deal. Obviously not the kind of thing a guy could pull off at all. If he were really a man, everyone in the universe would wake up Christmas morning to find a rotating musical chia pet under the tree, still in the store bag. If he were a man, there would be no reindeer, because they'd all be dead, gutted, and strapped to the rear bumper of the sleigh, and Blitzen's rack would already be on its way to the taxidermist. Although many of the Santa-related things I receive are sent as good-natured tokens of dissent with my family's position, I am frequently amazed at the animosity that is fostered by my feeble attempts to redirect the Christmastime focus from Santa Claus to Jesus Christ. My journey toward becoming a Santa dissenter began one Christmas Eve on a cobblestone street in a small German village. I looked up in the sky and watched the snowflakes gently dance toward the earth. This was my first Christmas away from home. Perhaps a combination of homesickness and self-pity was washing over me, but whatever the stimulus, it caused me to evaluate the differences between the U.S. Christmas celebrations and that which I was experiencing in Germany. Two of these included the separation of St. Nicholas, celebrated on the 6th of December, from the birth of Jesus Christ, celebrated for 2 days, 25 and 26 December. And on Christmas Eve, each child receives one gift from the Christ child, and then the family goes to midnight mass or some other church service. Since that night, so many years ago, I've returned to the Alps of Germany, Switzerland, and Austria to experience the Christmas seasons of my Christmas coming of age. Among my favorite experiences is that of standing on the site in Oberndorf, Austria, where Silent Night, in its original composition, was first written and performed. While my anti-Claus lecture is delivered with my tongue-in-cheek, in-your-face style, which some students call my shock-and-awe approach, I believe much in what I suggest is crucial for Christian people to consider. We face a growing secularization that is replacing Christmas, the celebration of the birth of Christ, with Xmas and Happy Holidays, the celebration of Santa Claus, and the commercial, worldly, deconstructionist agenda that attends this movement to neutralize any religious context for the celebration. I have carefully tracked some of the miscellanea associated with this encroachment. Some examples from recent years. As a result of the European Union-mandated European gender legislation, Woolworth's department store and other retail outlets must all stock Mother Christmas outfits and costumes to avoid being taken to court over sex discrimination. Russia has developed an anti-Claus movement, arguing that the American Santa Claus is replacing Grandfather Frost, a plump figure who wears a large golden sash, wears a hat like the old Tsars, and traditionally brings gifts to Russian children, and ruining Russian culture by replacing indigenous traditions with a capitalist image. Quote, unbridled consumerism and shop till you drop doctrines, unquote. Leaders of the movement were at the time scheduling an anti-Santa Claus festival and their own website, Grandfather Frost versus Santa Claus. The Supreme Court has ruled that the Christmas tree is not a religious symbol and can therefore be displayed in schools, government buildings, and other publicly owned venues. In Medford, Oregon, one man has decorated his front lawn with an image of Santa roasting the Grinch on a rotisserie. Neighbors complain that it's too R-rated for an outdoor light display. In New Zealand, a young boy threatened Santa that if he didn't bring him a computer, he would blow up the chimney. As I have studied and observed the secularization of the Christmas celebration, I felt compelled to expose several Santa Claus myths that people use to rationalize or justify their use of situational ethics in bringing Santa Claus into the celebration designed for remembering the birth of the Son of God. Myth number one. There really was a Santa Claus. Santa Claus is a creation of anti-Catholic, pro-commercial interests. It is a myth, even a lie, to believe or teach that Santa ever existed. He is not Kris Kringle, the Christ child, St. Nicholas, the Bishop of Myra, or any of the other historical persons he has been identified with. He is a creation of capitalist interests, promoted to sell objects of consumption. Santa Claus has evolved from a smorgasbord of pagan figures, fancied imagination, and religious bigotry. For centuries, European countries have celebrated some characters, real and imaginary, as part of traditional holidays and religious services. Among these are Odin, the Norse god who wears a white beard and rides a horse-drawn chariot through the sky. Kris Kringle, who was brought to the New World by the Pennsylvania Dutch and derives the name from the German phrase for Christchild, Christkindl. Saint Nicholas, the Catholic Bishop of Myra, meaning myrrh, the patron saint of children, as well as of maidens, lovers, merchants, sailors, robbers, and prostitutes. Nicholas is a real historical character who derived his reputation by giving to the needy and saving three daughters of a poor man from prostitution by throwing gold coins into their windows in order to provide a dowry for each. The Germans celebrate St. Nicholas on his name day, the 6th of December, by giving candy and small gifts to children. Sinterklaas. In Protestant Holland, the Dutch, attempting to humanize and make St. Nicholas less Catholic, but keep the tradition, have created Sinterklaas, a stern but kindly man who dressed in a bishop's gown and mitre to leave presents in the wooden shoes of good little boys and girls each December 6th. Sinterklaas came to New York, New Amsterdam, with the Dutch settlers of the 17th century, but he underwent a complete transformation as English settlers moved into the New York area, and their children envied the Dutch children's gifts and goodies obtained from Sinterklaas. The idea of celebrating a Catholic bishop was not acceptable to them. Neither was the celebration of ancient Catholic name days. Thus, they completely overhauled the image and persona to create Santa Claus, who more closely resembles the pagan god Thor. Some of Thor's more interesting descriptions include: he is the god of peasants and common people. He is portrayed as an elderly man, jovial and friendly, heavily built with a long white beard. His element is the fire. His color? Red. The sound of thunder is attributed to his rolling chariot. His chariot is drawn by two white goats named Cracker and Gnasher. He lives in the Northland. He is known as the Yule God. The fireplace in each home is sacred, and Thor is said to come down the chimney into his element, the fire. It's easy to see how Santa Claus could be manufactured out of such a myth. He was made even more visible by Clement Clark Moore's 1822 illustrated story, A Visit from St. Nicholas, now known more commonly as 'Twas the Night Before Christmas, the first textual and visual representation of our modern Santa Claus. His appearance heralded the modern celebrations of Christmas as we know them. By comparison, in the U.S. of 1776, there were no Christmas trees, no Christmas cards, and the holiday was not universally accepted as legitimate. It was actually banned in many communities, and much of the opposition was based on religious grounds. Christmas services reported in the New York Times for the 26th of December 1885 stated, quote, "The churches of the Presbyterians, Baptists, and Methodists were not open on December 25th, except where some mission schools had a celebration. They do not accept the day as a holy one, but the Episcopalian, Catholic, and German churches were all open. Inside, they were decked with evergreens," unquote. Other significant dates in our modern celebration of Santa Claus include 1886. Thomas Nast's drawing of Santa Claus appears in the 29th December 1886 Harper's Weekly. 1875, Christmas cards are introduced in America by Louis Prang of Boston. 1882, Utah legally recognizes Christmas as a holiday. 1897, Francis Church, editorial writer for the New York Sun, receives a letter from Virginia O'Hanlon asking, "Is there a Santa Claus?" His answer contains the now ubiquitous, "Yes, Virginia, there is a Santa Claus." 1920, emergence of commercial influence on the Christmas celebration. also marks the arrival of Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, sung by Gene Autry. Myth number two. Santa Claus represents the spirit of Christ. As a symbolic rather than historical figure, Santa Claus is the antithesis of Christ. It's an exaggeration and a charade to pretend that modern Santa Claus symbols have anything to do with the birth of Christ. They are mostly pagan in origin, and their meanings are far from appropriate for a celebration of Christ's birth. To exemplify this, compare the following. Giving is connected with Christ, while getting is connected with Santa. Just ask your children. Honesty is connected with Christ, while maintaining Santa's myth has led millions of parents to lie. Spirituality is connected with Christ, while worldliness, consumerism, and materialism is connected with Santa. Giving anonymously is connected with Christ, while giving to be seen is connected with Santa. Why else do we have the to and from tags on the gifts we give? The origin and stories of common Christmas symbols also betray their place as far removed from the purpose of Christmas. The Christmas Tree. Quote, "Learn not the way of the heathen, for the customs of the people are vain. For one cutteth a tree out of the forest, the work of hands of the workmen, with the axe. They deck it with silver and with gold. They fasten it with nails and with hammers, that it move not." Unquote. Jeremiah 10, 2-4. It has been suggested that the followers of Nimrod, the Antichrist, hung round ornaments representing eggs on their evergreen trees to symbolize the fertility granted by their pagan god. Holly berries were used anciently as symbols of sexuality, representing fertility, the propagation of life. The wreath shape was in honor of the sun's orbit, the reappearance of which was celebrated with the winter solstice. Not only have pagan and Santa symbols permeated our modern-day Christmas celebration, but Santa has become deified. Some people are deeply moved by depictions of Santa kneeling at the manger, present at the birth of Christ, and sold in some areas are depictions of Santa nailed to the cross. Furthermore, the concepts of omnipresence and omniscience, generally accepted as attributes of God, are now attributed to Santa. He sees you when you're sleeping. He knows when you're awake. Myth number three. Santa is part of a healthy fantasy world for children. There's no harm in it as a myth. It may not be harmful for children to have an element of the make-believe in their lives, but when we as parents and adults teach fantasy, we usually make sure children understand it as such. With Santa, however, we don't do this. We teach that he's real and make up lies and rationalizations to perpetuate these lies. Indeed, some people trace early fears and phobias to a belief in Santa Claus. A newspaper reporter recalls one of his colleagues who had a fear of Santa dating back to one of his childhood experiences. Quote, "We went to see Santa on Christmas Eve at a local department store. I thought something was kind of strange about him because his leg kept collapsing and the kids would slide off onto the floor. Then later, when we got home, my mother told me to run down to the corner tavern and tell my father to come home for dinner before he spent his Christmas bonus. When I walked into the tavern, there was my father and Santa, the one from the department store, in the middle of the barroom throwing punches at each other. I'll bet not many kids ever saw their father and Santa Claus duking it out on Christmas Eve." Unquote. And who can forget the Santa Claus scene in the movie Christmas Story, where the little boy visits Santa and is thrown down the chute? Additionally, it's suggested that the concept of Santa creates strains and irrational buying by parents who feel guilty because of the time they've spent away from their children during the past year. Quote, "More parents spending time at work and fewer spending time with children creates working parent guilt. The result? Feeling contrite, at times stolen from parenting, being more capable financially, working parents will overindulge their children in an effort to assuage their own guilt." In ads, toy makers exploit this guilt, unquote. Unrealistic expectations regarding Santa Claus create feelings of depression, disappointment, and general dissatisfaction that cause many people to be unhappy during the Christmas holidays. Many holiday depressions adults experience can be traced to overindulgence at Christmas time, indulgences which stop as children get older and Santa no longer showers them with gifts. The magic has worn off. Quote, children too often become depressed because they overbuild expectations in advance. Fantasies cannot match reality, no matter how wonderful the day may be, and disappointment soon follows, unquote. Sometimes children are set up by the Santa myth and must make major adjustments when things change unexpectedly in their lives. For example, I received the following letter. Quote, Dear Dr. Gillespie, 5 years ago, shortly before graduating, I came to hear your lecture. At first, I was annoyed and angered. Santa had been part of my childhood, and I recalled a sense of being a part of the grown-up world, an intimacy of shared secrets when I discovered that Santa wasn't real. 6 months later, when I faced an unexpected divorce, I had no idea that lecture would be part of helping me and my children adjust to a new life. By Christmas of that year, I realized so much had changed, and my whole perception of life was different. The old traditions also had to be rethought. My children had already been debunked of a number of myths, as they and I faced a very sober reality. At Christmas, I recalled your lecture and realized they deserve the truth at all times, not just sometimes. Children of divorce, children of the homeless, the poor, and the unemployed, these are the ones that know the reality of Santa and the harm that can come from such pretenses, unquote. My own research, conducted along Utah's Wasatch Front, shows an interesting connection between parent-child trust and the teaching of and belief in Santa Claus. In questionnaires given to high school students, I found that while almost all had been taught by their parents that there was a Santa, when they learned that he didn't exist, it came not from their parents, but from friends and teachers. I followed this question by asking from whom they had first found out about sex, drugs. And then I asked, taking everything you've been told about drugs and sex, who seemed to be the most truthful? In each instance, the high school students in my sample had learned more about sex and drugs from friends and others than they had from their parents. They also indicated that the most truthful information about these subjects came from friends, teachers, and others, not parents. I'm not sure I can lay all of the what's wrong with this picture trip at the feet of Santa Claus, but I find it to be an interesting comparison, and wonder about the extent to which children learn, at an early age, how honest their parents will be with them. Why would any Christian parents choose to begin their relationship with their children with a lie called Santa Claus, especially if they want their children to believe them when they teach them about Jesus Christ and a Father in heaven? When asked about their feelings upon finding that there's no Santa, some of these young people responded as follows. My parents disappointed me. I'm less excited about Christmas. Hurt. It was a big letdown. It ruined Christmas. They appeared ridiculous, going through all that trouble. I felt that I'd been betrayed. I was upset because I thought they had been telling the truth. I felt like they weren't honest with me. There is tremendous social pressure for parents to teach the existence of Santa, and in so doing to avoid having their children ostracized or excluded because of their non-belief. As I mentioned above, I have neighbors who refuse to allow their children to play with mine during Christmas, because mine don't believe in Santa Claus. I'm certainly not asked to speak or participate in church meetings during December for fear that I might ruin Christmas for the children in the ward. There have been threats to burn crosses on my lawn because of my outspoken criticism of the Santa myth and the culture of deceit that surrounds it. Yet, even though I don't recommend my activist approach to Santa descent for everyone, I'm continually amazed that people assume that anyone against Santa must be anti-Christmas. Is it blasphemous to celebrate the life and birth of Christ at a time set aside for such celebration? Is the assumption correct that children cannot appreciate the meaning of Christ's birth without adding Santa Claus into the mix so they can truly enjoy Christmas? Is it ridiculous to want to be consistently honest with our children? Maybe it is time that each of us individually reassess what we believe, why we believe it, and how it applies to our celebration of Christmas. That was Confessions of a Santa Dissenter by L.K. Gillespie. This next segment is entitled Confessions of a Shopping Mall Santa by Rory Swenson. Rory Swenson is a former chair of the Sunstone Board of Directors. Christmas season, 1989. I was a freshman at the University of Utah, my first year away from home. As a poor student, I was looking for extra holiday cash, and the Help Wanted ad for a shopping mall Santa seemed like just the thing. Despite my 18-year-oldness, the manager was desperate to fill the big chair. So I walked out of my short interview with a prosthetic belly, a red suit, a wig, and some bells. Christmas had lost its luster a decade before, the day I had gone searching for my swimming mask and snorkel in our travel trailer. It turned out that my parents had thought the travel trailer an ideal hiding place for Santa's loot. It had been, actually, until their young son decided that he needed a mask and snorkel in the dead of winter. I spent several years playing along, afraid to reveal that I knew the big secret, afraid that the loot would vanish. Life as an 18-year-old Santa wasn't very glamorous. I would lug a large suitcase to the mall and make my way upstairs, beyond the food court, into an access hallway, and finally to my dressing room. A janitor's closet, yes, literally, complete with mops, buckets, vacuums, and the acrid smell of cleaning agents. In this little room, I would transform into a fat, jolly elf. I'd put on my belly, don my red velvet suit, deftly apply the makeup to add decades to my face, and top it off with a beard, wig, and hat. I was Santa. On the outside, anyway. On the inside, I was recoiling from the ever-lengthening holiday season. The Christmas music beginning on Halloween, the in-store decorations just getting dusty before Thanksgiving, all presided over by the retail juggernaut. I wanted the magic of Christmas. I looked for it, but it had been elusive, making me weary and jaded. I'd sit in that janitor's closet and wait until I heard the sound of Santa Number One's bells coming down the hall. We'd exchange pleasantries, I'd wait a few minutes, and then, trying not to sweat, jog to the door and throw it open, shouting, "Ho, ho, ho!" "Trotting is best," the manager had told me. "It shakes the bells in a rhythmic fashion, it makes you look jolly, and it allows the youngsters to keep up." So I trotted down the stairs, trotted to Santa's village, and trotted to Santa's throne. It took a bit of politicking to talk as Santa to children. I saw their hope, their excitement, their wonder, and I wanted to keep that, not destroy it. But at the same time, I couldn't promise anything, especially when I saw anxious parents watching me, silently calculating the financial damage in their heads. A simple, "Santa will do his very best, and you have a Merry Christmas," was usually the best for everyone involved. After a while, though, I really got into this Santa thing. Even though I didn't feel the magic of Christmas myself, I seemed to have a knack for spreading it around. So I decided to use my Santa costume and visit friends from my hometown. A few days before Christmas, I started attending their holiday parties as the Fat Man, spreading that Santa-ness around. I loved it. One night, I was driving along a rural road on my way to another party. I saw a flash in my headlights and hit the brakes, but a sickening thump told me I had been too slow. I stopped and checked my rearview mirror. A deer's still bleeding body was crumpled in the middle of the road. I sat there, contemplating the slick roads and the falling snow. I couldn't just leave it. Another car was bound to be along soon. So I turned around and illuminated the scene with my headlights, then I got out of the car, grateful for the warmth of my Santa suit, and began pulling the deer to the side of the road. At that very moment, a van passed by. Slowly. Mom and Dad stared at me from the front seats. Several children's faces were plastered to the window. They looked as if they'd just witnessed a murder. Donner, dead. The big man trying to hide the evidence. Great job, Santa. The little girl on my lap was 8, maybe 9, and dressed in the finest winter apparel. She arrived with a mom to match. They'd probably arrived in a gold-trimmed Lexus. I braced myself for a long list of toys and clothes and games. But she was polite. She was tentative. And when the moment came, this young girl looked directly into my eyes, and with unquestionable and absolute sincerity, said simply, "I want the kids who don't get Christmas to have a Christmas this year." I wasn't prepared. I was speechless, choked up, stunned. What would you say? She believed in Santa. More than any other kid I had met, I could see it in her eyes. What's more, she was Christmas. The generosity, the charity, the love, all wrapped up in a little brunette bundle. Her hopes and wishes were genuine and heartfelt, and Santa could do this. He'd deliver. Last year, my older kids wanted electric scooters. Being well-trained consumers, my wife and I obliged. I ordered my daughter a really cute mini Vespa-looking thing, pink. UPS delivered it to the front door, except it arrived during Christmas vacation and the box had a big picture of the scooter prominently displayed on the outside. My daughter signed for it. Fairy tale imploded. I think I handled the whole thing well. Sure, there was trauma and tears, but after a good long talk, Santa had hired a new, world-wise little elf to help out on Christmas Eve. But it's one thing to have your hopes dashed by a UPS driver at the door with a scooter. It's quite another to wake up and realize that Santa hadn't come through yet again for all those kids who don't have a Christmas. I often think back to that earnest little girl. I wonder about her. She gave a young shopping mall Santa a gift, but where is she now? Likely a young mother with her own toddlers in tow, trying to find the spirit of the season she embodied so long ago. Perhaps it's best that I don't know her. Perhaps it's best that she lives on as a memory. But I still look for her in other places and in other faces, because her memory causes this Santa to be a little more reflective, a little more aware of the people around him, a little more willing to keep being Santa, even after the costume comes off. That was Confessions of a Shopping Mall Santa by Rory Swenson. That concludes this episode of the Sunstone Magazine podcast. Encourage your friends to join us by becoming a patron at patreon.com/sunstone. If you would like to further support Sunstone's efforts, visit sunstone.org/donate, where you can make a tax-deductible contribution. We'll be back soon with another installment of the Best of Mormon Thought and Experience. Thanks for listening.